As Charles learns to become an artist, he is tempted in the way that the Keats Ode tempts to find the eternal through the temporal in art. Now, this is a temptation that Sebastian himself gives voice to. I'm on page 79. The opening of chapter 4. This is one of the most famous passages in the novel. I don't have time to read it, but do look it over. The languor of youth, how unique and quintessential it is, how quickly, how irrecoverably lost. It's a beautiful passage. But of course, at the end of that first chapter, first paragraph, perhaps in the mansions of limbo, the heroes enjoy some such compensation for their loss of the beatific vision. That's the way it is in Dante, that first circle. Those great classical figures that Dante knows cannot go to heaven in the first circle are really living a nice life. But it's a quiet and languorous life. They're sort of wandering around having a perpetual picnic on a perpetual summer day, chatting with each other and living in a big castle. There is a hint of Charles and Sebastian during that summer there. Because they cannot ever go to heaven. Perhaps the beatific vision itself has some remote kinship with this lowly experience. Could well be. An echo of something. In the same way that the echoes of the false love, still a kind of love, will eventually teach Charles about divine love. So this sort of sense of languor, the beauty of being there, can teach him of something higher. But notice he says, I at any rate believed myself very near heaven during those languid days at Brideshead. Well, he's wrong. But he believed it because there was a beauty there. Why is this house called a castle? It used to be one until they moved it. What can you mean? Just that. We had a castle a mile away down by the village. Then in Inigo Jones's time, we took a fancy to the valley and pulled the castle down. The will of man. Well, let's have the castle over here. Well, let's have a different church. Carted the stones up here and built a new house. I'm glad they did, aren't you? If it was mine, I'd never live anywhere else. But you see, Charles, it isn't mine. Just at the moment it is, but usually it's full of ravening beasts. If it could only be like this always, always summer, always alone, the fruit always ripe, and Aloysius in a good temper. It is the longing for permanence in those moments of beauty. Keats says you can find it in art. Charles seeks it in art at first, okay? And where he first finds it is in what he calls a conversion experience, okay? I am on page 82. And he talks about the change. He'd always nursed a love of architecture, though in opinion I had made that easy leap, characteristic of my generation, from the Puritanism of Ruskin to the Puritanism of Roger Fry. My sentiments were at heart insular and medieval. This was my conversion to the Baroque. Here under that high and insolent dome, under those tricky ceilings, here as I passed through those arches and broken pediments, to the pillared shade beyond and sat hour by hour before the fountain, probing its shadows, tracing its lingering echoes, rejoicing in all its clustered feats of daring and invention, I felt a whole new system of nerves alive within me, as though the water that spurted and bubbled among its stones was indeed a life-giving spring. This conversion experience by the water makes him feel as if he's found new life. Well, this, of course, is emblematic of what he will really find. It's real, and he does come to love the Baroque. And why the Baroque? Wall loved the Baroque. Because it is the Counter-Reformation art form. It's that art form that grew out of that whole movement when the church, with renewed energy, began fighting the Reformation. So it's not accidental that Charles's conversion to the Baroque is a step in his conversion process. It's an aesthetic conversion, but it's a step in the right direction. And it will sustain him for a while. And please remember, the fountain in a way becomes a symbol again of the Baroque, but it is false Baroque. The symbol also is cobbled together. Whenever you find anything in this novel that is cobbled together from pieces that don't seem to fit, it may be imitating something that's real, but if it's cobbled together, it's not real. And if you, quickly, the description of the fountain, page 81. An oval basin with an island of formal rocks at its center. On the rocks grew in stone formal tropical vegetation and wild English fern in its natural fronds. Through them ran a dozen streams that counterfeited springs. And round them sported fantastic tropical animals, camels and camelopards, and an ebullient lion all vomiting water. On the rocks, to the height of the pediment, stood an Egyptian obelisk of red sandstone. But by some odd chance, for the thing was far beyond me, I brought it off. He's drawing it. And by judicious omissions and some stylish tricks, produced a very passable echo of Piranesi. Shall I give it to your mother, I asked. Why, you don't know her. It seems polite, I'm staying in her house. Give it to Nanny, said Sebastian. I did so, and she put it among the collection on the top of her chest of drawers. And a drawing that is filled with omissions and stylish tricks of an inauthentic cobbled-together fountain cannot be a gift for Lady Marchmain, who's the real thing, okay? So that it goes to Nanny, who just collects anything. If the children give her something, it's wonderful. Up it goes on that mantle. But it can't go to Lady Marchmain. And this is indicative that Charles, from the beginning, is tempted by little tricks of style. Things he's learning to get by. That's not authentic. But when he is doing those drawings in the garden room, and Lady Marchmain comes in and says, who did the beautiful drawings? And praises them, we know Charles has done something real. The praise of Lady Marchmain, who has a good eye, I spoke about her room last night, is real praise. It's authentic. So there is the ability there to do something that is real and lasting. Please notice, the fountain is often the place in which the inauthentic is put forward, but it is also the scene where the fountain is the place where, if you remember, Charles says, ought we to be drunk every night? And Sebastian says, yes, I think so, okay? It's funny, but it's not an authentic sentiment. But it's also the scene at the end where Julia finally speaks from her very soul and overcomes it and rails at Charles, not just in terms of who she is, the way she's living, but then accuses him of comparing her to a picture, of reducing what she is feeling to a picture. Let's turn to that just for a moment. I'm on page 290. They've had the scene outside. They have a brief little talk. They're in their room upstairs. They've been at the fountain. They're going upstairs. Julia, have you ever seen a picture of Holman Hunt's called The Awakened Conscience? No. I'd seen a copy of Pre-Raphaelitism in the library some days before. I found it again and read her Ruskin's description. She laughed quite happily. You're perfectly right. That's exactly what I did feel. It's the painting of a woman of easy virtue who suddenly comes to the realization of the kind of life she's been living. It's called The Awakened Conscience. He remembers the painting after her explosion of the fountain about how she feels as if she is living in sin. No way back, the gates barred, all the saints and angels posted along the walls. Then they go back outside by the fountain, and he turns it all into a drama. Act 1, sunset. Act 2, dusk. Act 3, moonlight. The characters keep assembling at the fountain for no very clear reason. Oh, don't talk in that damn bounderish way. Why must you see everything secondhand? Why must this be a play? Why must my conscience be a pre-Raphaelite picture? It's a way I have. I hate it. And she takes the switch and slashes him across the face, saying, this is real. My pain is real. What I'm going through is real. It's not art. It's not secondhand. It's not observed. And what we have, Charles at that point still turning everything into art, because he cannot look straight on. He is still concerned with those merely artistic questions. It's the wonderful debate that goes on between Charles and Bridie about the chapel. I'm on page 92. They're talking about the chapel, and Bridie turns to Charles and says, you are an artist, writer. What do you think of it aesthetically? I think it's beautiful, said Cordelia with tears in her eyes. Now, obviously, what we are getting before this little debate begins is the correct answer. Cordelia finds the chapel beautiful. She's the truth teller. It means the chapel is beautiful. But the reason Cordelia finds the chapel beautiful is because our Lord resides there. That's where she goes to pray to our Lord. She's not talking about the surroundings. The surroundings are made beautiful because that red light is there. Christ is in the tabernacle. Hence, it is a beautiful place. It proclaims the glory of God, just as certainly as nature does. But Bridie, pursuing it, says, is it good art? Well, I don't quite know what you mean, I said warily. I think it's a remarkable example of its period. Probably in 80 years, it will be greatly admired. Bridie, but surely it can't be good 20 years ago and good in 80 years and not good now. Well, it may be good now. All I mean is that I don't happen to like it much. But is there a difference between liking a thing and thinking it good? Bridie's just wonderful. Bridie, don't be so Jesuitical, says Sebastian. But I knew that this disagreement was not a matter of words only, but expressed a deep and impassable division between us. Neither had any understanding of the other, nor ever could. Now, it continues for a while, but that notion, the difference between what we like and what is good, a hugely important distinction. And Charles has taste, because that's what he's learned, but does not yet understand the good in a higher sense. Meaning, again, his knowledge of art isn't leading him anywhere. It's not going anywhere. Even though at this point he is able to do some good work. I'm running out of time. Let me move quickly here. He converts to the Baroque. He sketches the fountain but cheats on it. He does a few romantic landscapes of land around Brideshead, and the brush somehow moves very, very easily under his fingers. He does the paintings in the garden room, which Lady Marchmain says are beautiful, and everyone seems to like them. Lady Marchmain, by the way, he uses her paints. If you remember, we learned that at one point, someone told her that you couldn't appreciate the world unless you painted it. And Lady Marchmain gets paints to try to paint, and we find out that all the colors smudged, and he looks on the palette and indeed sees that on the palette all the colors had run together. She's not an artist. Why not? She doesn't have to be. She sees the world directly. She is a saintly woman, if not a saint, and therefore can see directly. She doesn't need the intermediary. She can't paint. But Charles uses those paints that she bought to paint the garden room. Then he has his greatest triumph, which is indeed a Marchmain house, in which he is painting that which is going to be torn down. And we get that passage where he talks about much of the work he did as an artist came from the fact that people would hire him to paint things that they were going to have torn down. After my first exhibition, I was called to all parts of the country to make portraits of houses that were soon to be deserted or debased. Indeed, my arrival seemed often to be only a few paces ahead of the auctioneers, a presage of doom. He's holding to an aesthetic, but the aesthetic is dying. He again is the kind of forerunner of doom. He gets there, paints it, boom, down it comes. What's he trying to do? Preserve that which is vanishing in time. Preserve something that cannot finally be preserved. Marchmain House, torn down, but nevertheless, he does good paintings of them. But what he can't paint and doesn't paint is people. And what we get is that flaw in him again, that he can at the beginning paint nature, he can paint architecture, structured, ordered, and see it and render it, but he can't paint people. He doesn't know what they're about. And then the descent, the clear sign that he has failed as an artist, he goes off to Mexico and goes back to paint those primitive, godless temples and buildings that again deserted, not his own country, and comes back with them, and everyone's excited because they're barbaric and primitive. He has the big exhibit, and of course it's taking place simultaneously as his marriage falls apart, and his treatment of his wife is very like the barbaric buildings he's painted. It is a marriage without love, just as his paintings are without value. He's been emptied, if you will. He has, in essence, and notice the parallel here, married the sister of Boy Malcaster. He's going to fall in love with the sister of Sebastian. Boy Malcaster, empty and phony. Sebastian, the real thing, though troubled. Celia, concerned with art and fashion. Julia, concerned with higher things. So on the crossing, on that boat, when he falls in love, a false love that cannot be sustained, but it is still a movement, it is still a reawakening for him of a kind. When he falls in love, for the first time he begins to do portraits. First time he ever does portraits. And what he's doing is portraits of Julia. He looks at her on the boat. He sees her. She had lost that fashionable spidery look. The head that I used to think Quattrocento, which had sat a little oddly on her, was now part of herself and not at all Florentine. Not connected in any way with painting or the arts or with anything except herself. So it would be idle to itemize and dissect her beauty, which was her own essence and could only be known in her and by her authority and in the love I was soon to have for her. And he can't look at her as an object to be painted. He has to look at her as a real woman. It is movement forward. It is a wrong and adulterous and sinful relationship. But what he is able to see in her is a kind of real beauty. He is going again from being phony to attempting to be genuine. He comes back from Latin America and says, I came back, I remained unchanged, he says, still a small part of myself pretending to be whole. The very words that Julia has used to describe Rex Matrim. And what she's doing now is making another alliance with a man who's only part of himself. Because what Charles is missing is the spiritual side of himself. What Rex was missing was the whole caboodle except for money and politics. Okay? Notice how many of the people in this novel are partial people. Anthony Blanche, the aesthetic, concerned with art. Rex Matrim, the politician, concerned with money and power. Mr. Samgrass, the intellectual, concerned with academia and the intellect. Okay? They all are partial people in partial worlds, out for something on their own. Celia, her art and fashion. Okay? Just point by point by point, we have these partial people. And Charles admits at that point, he's one of them. With the Flight family, we have real people, although deeply flawed and sinful. But they are somehow, they're whole and they're moving somewhere and they are human enough to have the possibility in them that something can come of them. It's a wonderful moment here. Charles is talking to Bridie, page 282. Mm-mm. How is the painting, Charles? Which painting? Whatever you have on the stocks. I began a sketch of Julia, but the light was tricky all today. Julia, I thought you'd done her before. It's the brother talking about this. You painted her once. You're painting her again? I suppose it's a change from architecture and much more difficult, says Bridie. Well, yes, it is. It's absolutely true. His conversation abounded in long pauses, during which his mind seemed to remain motionless. He always brought one back with a start to the exact point where he had stopped. Now, after more than a minute, he said, "The world is full of different subjects." Very true, Bridie. "If I were a painter, I should choose an entirely different subject every time. Subjects with plenty of action in them, like..." Another pause. What I wondered was coming. The Flying Scotsman, the Charge of the Light Brigade, Henley Regatta. Then surprisingly he said, "Like Macbeth." You know, where it comes from. Who knows? I mean, you can't follow his logic at all. But then he had a kind of massive rectitude and impermeability, an indifference to the world which compelled respect. Though we often laughed at him, he was never wholly ridiculous. At times he was even formidable. And he will be so when his father begins to die. He will be the one who goes and gets Father Mackay the first time. I mean, God bless Bridie. Eccentric, an eccentric person, but a person, okay? But Charles is painting Julia. Love has brought him to that point. He can see her in a different way. And it is through the death of the father that Charles comes to learn that which is authentic, okay? That which is absolutely authentic. The journeys here always take place through other people. I've skipped over one thing. I'll say it very briefly. Sebastian finds, finally, his road to salvation through this awful German, a fellow named Kurt. And he finds it because, as he says, he finally found someone who needs him, that he can be of service to. Although Sebastian says, it had to be somebody pretty pathetic to need me. And when Charles visits him when he's in the hospital in Morocco, the monk who takes him to see Sebastian says, "Oh, he's very good to a German boy that lives with him, a real Samaritan." And Charles says, "You know, I thought, poor booby, God forgive me." Because Charles comes to realize that Sebastian, by finally caring for someone else other than himself, has broken out of his selfishness, and it is indeed the beginning of Sebastian's growing up. Giving up the teddy bear, giving up his nanny, giving up all those childish things. And we're back to that moment when Charles first goes to the luncheon at Sebastian's and says, "But then I had not yet learned the great truth that to know and love one other human being is the beginning of wisdom." The beginning of wisdom. It's not wisdom. But until you can break out of selfishness and connect in a bond in any way with another human being, you have not begun the process of knowing what charity is. And Sebastian is being kind and helpful to Kurt. And indeed, wanders around searching for him until he finds that he's hanged himself. And then that profound shock sends him off to the monastery in Carthage. Where we learn from Cordelia what his probable end will be, I won't go through it all. I'll just say this. Then one morning after one of his drinking bouts, he'll be picked up at the gate dying and show by a mere flicker of the eyelid that he is conscious when they give him the last sacraments. It's not such a bad way of getting through one's life. I thought of the joyful youth with the teddy bear under the flowering chestnuts. "It's not what one would have foretold," I said. "I suppose he doesn't suffer." "Oh, yes, I think he does. One can have no idea what the suffering may be to be maimed as he is. No dignity, no power of will. No one is ever holy without suffering. It's taken that form with him. I've seen so much suffering in the last few years. There's so much coming for everybody soon. It's the spring of love. And we get the image of the water rising up again. But real water, the spiritual water, the heavenly water, the baptismal water of renewal and the new life. And that's where we leave Sebastian, who has managed through this grotesque German who shoots his foot off to finally come to his true resting place. For Charles, it takes place through Lord Marchmain and his love of Julia and the battle that goes on between the two of them. If Charles begins as an example of religious indifferentism, and you can find the passages all through the beginning, he just doesn't care, he's not interested, it never occurred to him until he meets this family, and they talk about nothing else. He goes beyond that, and that gets passed to Rex Mottram. And I don't have time, but that glorious comic scene of Rex converting just so he can marry Julia, that is so inauthentic that it brings out the worst in Cordelia. If you ever get downhearted about anything, pick up those pages and read them, and your day will be brightened instantly. Comedy so profound and wonderful is very hard to come by. It's marvelous comedy. But at the end of the novel, Charles is arguing with Julia about whether or not her father should see a priest. He is trying to prevent that priest from going in to see Lord Marchmain. It matters, and you better believe it matters, because he knows deep inside, if it happens, it's the end of his love. That's the test. Charles goes beyond Keats's truth and beauty in the world to the ultimate question in the world, which is life and death. As I said, what's the book about? Love and death. Those two most authentic things. And here, what Charles thinks of as his love hinges on the life and death of Lord Marchmain. What we have here is something that had not really happened, I think, since the Middle Ages. You have to go back to the medieval morality play Everyman to find anything like this, where the fate of a single soul decides and finally culminates an entire work of art. This is medieval. But unlike Everyman, which is allegorical, what Waugh has done is give us an actual living, breathing human being who has run from his church, who has lived in sin, who has now come back home, drawn home, desperately clinging to life. Charles says to the doctor, he has a wonderful will to live, doesn't he? And the doctor says, oh, my, I should say he has a terrible fear of death. And that's what it is. Lord Marchmain keeps saying, better today, better tomorrow. When spring comes, I'll go out in the car. And that sense that somehow he's going to recover when it's clear he's not going to recover. None of us is going to recover. Each day, we're a day closer to the grave. Some merely closer than others. And he is there. And the question becomes the fate of his soul. It matters. That this should actually show up in a 20th century work of art is a great grace from God. That the book is available and we're reading it and that other people have read it and that it was turned into a TV series that's magnificent, the only excuse for the existence of television, the only work of, I mean that, I'm serious. It's the only real work of art ever created for television. And that's no accident. The greatest actors of the day, the director dies halfway through and another director comes in and you can't tell where one left off and the other begins. It is a masterpiece because they film the novel. It's a great grace. It's there. And in the midst of this horror and the apostasy everywhere and the devil riding triumphant, this book poses the question that the single most important question in any individual life is, will your soul be saved or will your soul be damned? Extraordinary. And it's not just a character changing his mind. We're back to what I said earlier, Ars Moriendi, the art of dying. The art of dying well, but it's a question and it's a fight. And of course, what happens is that Julia, having acknowledged at the fountain in that explosion, which Waugh said, people say, well, that's not realistic. That's not realistic. And Waugh said, well, it doesn't matter if it's realistic. What happens at that moment is that the divine intervenes, and it is a voice of the divine that speaks out of Julia. It is everything in the tormented soul just pouring forth at the fountain, and it's all true. And she recognizes it, including the horrible suffering of her mother dying with cancer, praying for the family, which she links directly to the suffering of Christ on the cross. Christ dying with her sin, she says. This is in a 20th century novel, for heaven's sake. A popular one. And we come to the very end, and it's very simple. Page 338. Lord Marchmain gets last rites. Now, said the priest, I know you are sorry for all the sins of your life, aren't you? Make a sign if you can. You're sorry, aren't you? But there was no sign. Try and remember your sins. Tell God you are sorry. I am going to give you absolution. While I am giving it, tell God you are sorry you have offended him. He began to speak in Latin. I recognized the words, Ego te absolvo in nomine Patris, and saw the priest make the sign of the cross. Then I knelt too and prayed, O God, if there is a God, forgive him his sins, if there is such a thing as sin. And the man on the bed opened his eyes and gave a sigh, the sort of sigh I had imagined people made at the moment of death, but his eyes moved so that we knew there was still life in him. Notice it happens the moment Charles prays. It's an inauthentic prayer he doesn't believe, but he prays. And at that moment, Lord Marchmain begins to show the last sign of life. God can work through the inauthentic. It is possible. Just before this, Father Mackay has reminded everyone, Christ came to call not the righteous, but sinners to repentance. And Julia has already repented. She will not be with Charles ever again. And Charles is now the repenting sinner who is kneeling down, not knowing what he's doing, saying words he's not sure he even believes. But God is giving two signs there. One, first, in that inauthentic prayer that Charles makes, Charles gets the sign that the prayer was heard. Because Lord Marchmain's eyes move, and then I suddenly felt the longing for a sign, if only of courtesy, if only for the sake of the woman I loved, who knelt in front of me praying, I knew for a sign. It seems so small a thing that was asked. The bare acknowledgement of a present, a nod in the crowd. All over the world, people were on their knees before innumerable crosses, and here the drama was being played again by two men, by one man rather, and he nearer death than life, the universal drama in which there is only one actor. Now, Charles thinks he means Father Mackay and Lord Marchmain. But it's Charles and Lord Marchmain. Because Charles is about to come to an awareness of his own sin. It's going to be thrust on him. Charles is going to end up converting. If Lady Marchmain's death has somehow drawn all the family back, this is the moment when something happens to Charles. Suddenly, Lord Marchmain moved his hand to his forehead. I thought he had felt the touch of the chrism and was wiping it away. Oh, God, I pray, don't let him do that. And he doesn't. But there was no need for fear. The hand moved slowly down his breast, then to his shoulder, and Lord Marchmain made the sign of the cross. Then I knew that the sign I had asked for was not a little thing, not a passing nod of recognition, and a phrase came back to me from my childhood of the veil of the temple being rent from top to bottom. Astounding. It's astounding. If such words can be put down, if such a scene can be written, in this God-forsaken century, well, the last one, we're still in it, We're still in the demonism of the last one. It's spilled over and increasing. If such a thing can be written down with such beauty and truth that is not just art, but a sign of something higher, then anything is possible and God is there. And of course, at that last moment, what does Charles find but that light still burning? The one authentic thing in Brideshead. The chapel, the red light. And the artistry of the chapel doesn't matter. What he finds there is that red light, and he kneels and prays, as he says, a newly learned form of word. He's still trying to do it. He's still trying to learn it. And he leaves cheerful. But he has lost Julia. He gives up the romantic nonsense. He gives up the false idea of art. He gives up the false love. But without it, he couldn't have come here. God can use anything to bring a soul home. Because God's grace is everywhere and can strike at the most unexpected moments in the most unexpected ways. And Charles uses the image of an avalanche. Himself, the trapper in the hut, the snow is rumbling, and suddenly the avalanche comes down and sweeps everything away. That's God's grace. God's grace is an avalanche, and you cannot withstand it when he sends it. And it is cold, white, and pure. It's a perfect image. Oddly, we learn nothing else about Charles the painter. But we do learn something about Charles the artist. Does he paint anymore? We don't know. But we do know he does one last great work of art. He writes a book called Brideshead Revisited. And Charles Ryder, like Waugh, goes from being an artist with paint to an artist with words. And the book is the sacred and profane memories of the memoirs of Charles Ryder. Brideshead Revisited. This is the book. This is Charles's story. It is a work of art. In the truest sense, it points heavenward. It is true. It is beautiful, but not for its own sake. Because here we have no enduring city. But what this book is built on is not that jumbled castle, but the heavenly city that it finally points toward that each one of us can find heading off on the path that Charles finds by the end of the book. Young men, you are going out into that mess, and it's worse now than in 1944. But take this with you, because it is not Scripture, it is not the divine word, but it is the word in a worldly sense, by a brilliant writer, a good Catholic, and it is a sign. Word as sign, in the correct way, that points in the right direction. You are going to need it. It can comfort you, it can console you, it can delight you, but it must first and foremost remind you of the ultimate fact. In the midst of the horror, the depravity, the degradation, the demonic collapse of the world from coast to coast and sea to sea, each individual soul, no matter how sunk in sin, how gravely astray, how lost, can be brought back by God's grace. And you may well be the one to have the mark on your soul for all eternity to help those poor souls back, to call the sinner to redemption and get that soul to heaven. It will take courage, it will take prayer, it will take sacrifice, it will take suffering. But as the wonderful Cordelia says, suffering is the spring of love. Thank you. Got a couple minutes for questions. Not long. Not long, yes.
There's a wonderful passage on the boat about Learkent and the fool.
Yep.
What the heck?
Yeah, yeah. To be quite honest, I've puzzled over that for a long while, and I haven't cracked that nut yet. But I think there is a sense in which Charles is calling up something again that he doesn't quite fully understand, because he says each of us is all three. In that sense, the father who destroys, by the way, Charles abandons his own children. He ends up, you know, in a way as bad as all the other fathers, but he acknowledges it at the end. And that little sentimental, he has a moment of sort of sentimentality before he goes to the chapel. You know, he's given up the right to see his children, he says. The fool, wisdom coming out of the most unlikely mouths and the most unlikely places. And Kent, loyalty. And there is a kind of loyalty even among this shattered family. They are held together. That's an attempt, but it is a puzzling statement. It's a puzzling statement, yeah.
At the first lunch party with Anthony Blanche, why is he reading The Wasteland in that certain section of The Wasteland?
You know what, that section is an awful moment where we get, it's in the scene where the typist comes home for lunch and is having her tin and the young man arrives and there is the meaningless act of love. So what you get is The Wasteland in the sense of desolation everywhere, which the young were reading. The young were responding to it. They somehow felt Eliot had touched on something, but it is also a vision of empty love, which is going to be something, a pattern that's going to run throughout the novel, that will run throughout the novel, that false, empty attachment. It's not mechanical in the book the way, it's almost mechanized love in The Wasteland. But it is still a false love, a love that is not true. Yeah.
It was said that Harold Acton was one of the prime popularizers of T.S. Eliot at Oxford.
Yes.
And so it's
Anthony who is modeled on Acton. Yeah, who's out there with the, I love it, the megaphone, shouting it out. And of course those who are coming back from the water are pointing and laughing at him. Well, Anthony is, they're the Rexes, they're the future Rex Matrons. Anthony's closer to something, but he's still not correct. By the way, the last time we see Anthony Blanche, he gives that devastating critique of the paintings and says, you know, I warned you about charm. These barbaric paintings, it's just pure old English charm, he says. I warned you about charm. It blights everything. It kills everything. It kills art. I fear it has killed you, Charles, he says. And this is in a gay bar called the Blue Grotto. Which again, it's a vision of sunkenness. The last time we see Antony, he's below the waters again. That vision of Oxford at the beginning being swept away. And again, it's the sense that all of that's going to be wiped out. It's all going underwater. And it's pathetic that Anthony Blanche at the beginning is witty and wonderful, is now hanging around with these truly debased, degenerate types. And that's where we leave him. That is a harsh judgment by Waugh on his former friends. And what had become of them, who had so much to promise and end up giving nothing, if you will, sunk in the Blue Grotto, as he calls it, a pansy bar. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, when Anthony characterizes Lady Marchmain, you say that that's the worst, the most untruthful description of all. Can we read anything into that, particularly insofar as that she is the saintly character and he is, well...
Well, he mischaracterizes everyone, but he particularly is unfair to her.
He accuses her of being, and I don't know, maybe that passage, what he was actually talking about her being a bloodsucker, I kind of read that maybe as a double entendre.
I wouldn't go that far, but what it means is she drains the life out of everyone by refusing to allow them to do what they want to do. Okay? And in that, but in fact, what she is doing is, she's going to end up sacrificing herself for them. Because it's very clear. We're not told it. Waugh doesn't have to tell us. As she's lying in that bed dying of that cancer, we know what she's praying for. We know what that suffering's being used for. Again, because the pictures of the seven dolors. I mean, she is in terrible pain, and it's that suffering for her children. She is a real mother in that sense. Yeah. And as I said, she becomes the means by, obviously the first means by which the family comes back. Curiously, it's Lord Marchmain's death that brings Charles in finally. Yes.
How is it, Doctor, that the book was so well received? Was it purely as a work of rhetoric?
Because it's beautifully written, because people responded to the magnificent story. It's a greatly structured story. It's a wonderful story. They know there's truth there. They're drawn to it. They can tell. But I will tell you the problem. It's the problem that Hollywood had at first, which is why they never made the film. They demanded he change the ending. I remember when I watched it, when the series was first on TV, and all my colleagues who watch TV, they don't read books, even though they teach literature. So they didn't know the story. They had not read it. So they're watching it week by week by week, and the morning after the last episode, I went in, and they were livid. I mean, furious. They had been cheated of their happy ending. Because they want Julia and Charles together. Hollywood wanted Julia and Charles together. We are awash in the romanticism that seduces Charles for much of the book. And Waugh will not have it. To become a grown-up and save your soul means giving up these foolish romantic attachments. Well, they wouldn't do it. I mean, they were livid. They felt cheated. They felt betrayed. It's so magnificent, but what a lousy ending. But that is the worldly vision, and they're all still stuck in that, absolutely stuck in that. So they responded to it until the end. And again, in that sense, what do we have? We have a shocking ending that rattled people, and that's a good thing. That's a good thing, yes.
Do modern people, particularly young people, like the kids you teach, do they get much out of this book? Because I know a lot of it probably went over our heads.
Well,
I don't know how much
you
go over.
What I do, they come in, they respond, they don't understand it. As I said, I've never taught it in a class, I teach it one-on-one. I sit there, I will answer questions. They have hundreds of, it's fire questions. We talk and talk and talk and talk, and as you talk about it, guess what comes up? And suddenly we have a ground on which we can talk about serious subjects in a work of art, where they don't have to feel threatened, and they can ask the questions without having to sort of get it straight on. Sort of, I'm not pulling my old Baltimore catechism off the shelf and saying, now sit there, listen, here I'm going to tell you. But what they're getting here are all the answers. It's here. It's absolutely here. And it's, again, this is what's most important. It's coming out of the world they know. Again, this is the world you're going into. It's a wreck. It's a mess. It's in collapse. It's horrible. Waugh says, doesn't matter. God's grace can still find these people. It's there for them. Yes, Father.
His letters of correspondence to Cardinal Hina.
Yes.
Started to change the mass. You can see that suffering going on in him because he joined the church because of his majestic beauty. And he now sees the new mass taking it down so much the better. And
yes.
Correspondence with the, when I read the book again, it's almost prophetic or apocalyptic.
Yes. Yes.
These are the things he saw after Vatican II happening to his church.
He stopped writing. Yeah. They asked him why. He said, Vatican II knocked the guts out of me. Right. He prayed to God to take him home. He couldn't stand it anymore. And talk about a good death. He found a priest who came and said the Tridentine Mass for him on Easter Sunday morning. He had dinner with his family, went upstairs and died. Yeah. Talk about a good death. Boy. What, I view it as rather a nice little reward for work well done. Let me just say a couple of other books, if you don't know them. His Helena, his novel about St. Helena, read it. The great World War II trilogy, Sword of Honor, 3 volumes. You can find it in one big book, Sword of Honor, brilliant. It is human, it's human and rich the way that Brideshead is. Although I do believe this is his masterpiece. Although Waugh believed Helena was his masterpiece. And it's a beautiful novel about the life of St. Helena and the finding of the true cross. It's a magnificent novel. Thank you again.